Sarah Hansel Keehan.
I'm Liz de Castro Brás.
And I'm Charlotte Usselman, first timer on the podcast. Can I say that, Kara?
Yeah.
Yes.
Welcome, Charlotte.
I'm so happy to be here.
And this is Behind the Bench from AJP Heart and Circ. Today, we're talking with Kate Weeks, first author of the recently published article titled FOXO1 is required for physiological cardiac hypertrophy induced by exercise, but not by constitutively active PI3K. Kate completed a double undergraduate degree in biochemistry and molecular biology and history at the University of Melbourne. The history side of her degree, according to Kate, taught her how to write and communicate, which is essential for scientists. On that point, I think we can all agree. During her honors year, Kate did a one-year research program in Julie McMullen's lab. After her PhD, Kate did her postdoc at King's College London, then headed back to the Baker. Kate's work has taken a path punctuated by maternity leave number one and maternity leave number two. What started in 2010 as a PhD research project eventually became the paper we will be talking about today. After hitting the pause button on this research for 6 years, for those intervening maternity leaves and resulting adorable babies, Kate did what the queen herself instructs. She carried on. I asked Kate if she ever considered just abandoning the project as science flotsam and jetsam. Kate's answer? No, because she did not understand what was happening in those mice. Along the way, Kate's husband has been incredibly supportive, all the while maintaining his own career, being a great dad, and sharing in Kate's scientific curiosity. Doesn't this sound like the makings for a great podcast? We think so. Liz, let's get this conversation started.
Thank you, Kara, and thank you, Kate and Charlotte, for joining me today. Very excited to have you both here. So, Kate, just to start off our conversation, can you give us a little summary about the work you described in your manuscript?
Sure. The focus of our lab is IGF-1 PI3K signaling. And the reason we're so interested in this signaling pathway is because it is cardioprotective in settings of disease. So we've done a number of studies that show that if you activate PI3K in the heart, it can actually improve heart function in mouse models of heart disease. So we're really excited by that and trying to develop therapies to actually target PI3K in the heart. But we don't actually know a lot about what's happening downstream of PI3K to cause these cardioprotective effects. So this study was looking at whether FOXO1, which is a transcription factor, is important for mediating PI3K signaling. And the key thing that PI3K does in the heart is actually induce physiological cardiac hypertrophy. So this is the type of heart growth that occurs in settings of chronic exercise. So elite athletes have an enlarged heart because they're doing so much exercise. And this is due to activation of the PI3K signaling pathway. We thought that FOXO1 might be acting downstream of PI3K. And so the aim of this project was to investigate that.
So Kate, when I was reading your paper, when I first read the title, I thought, oh boy, this is a little outside my wheelhouse, so this is going to be a real task. But I have to say, and I'm not just buttering up the guest, this paper was beautifully written. I really found like I followed it all the way through. So yeah, kudos to you. Your scientific writing is gorgeous, I must say. So as I was reading the introduction, I wanted to ask about the rationale, because you state that a lot of the things that we understand about FOXO1 and really cardiac hypertrophy have come from in vitro models, and that it's important to test these hypotheses and pathways in in vivo models. So could you expand a little bit on the differences between, you know, what you learned from an in vitro study and why we need these in vivo studies to build on those findings?
Yeah, so I guess the key thing is that the heart is an organ that is made up of lots and lots of different cell types. So when we do in vitro studies, we typically are using one particular cell type. And for this kind of study, you'd be using heart muscle cells because they're the cells that actually hypertrophy and grow. But in a whole heart setting, there are lots and lots of cells and they might be talking to one another and different things are going to be happening in all those different tissues. And so to look at the system as a whole, you really need to look in a whole animal at the organ. You also can't really get a feel for what happens to heart function, like what the heart's actually doing to pump blood around the body, unless you look at it as a whole. So that's why it's really important to go in vivo. The other thing is that we can actually manipulate genes in mice to make these genetically modified mice. And that's a really, really powerful way to investigate the function of different genes and proteins in an in vivo setting. So for this study, we used some cardiomyocyte-specific FOXO1 knockout mice. So we deleted FOXO1 specifically from the cardiomyocytes to see what the impact would be on the whole heart when we exercised the mice and also when we increased PI3K activity.
Wonderful. And actually, that leads into my next question, which was, were you involved then in the creation of these knockout mice?
So to make the mice, we had to cross two different mouse strains. So we already had the alphamycin heavy chain Cre transgenic mice. So Cre is a protein that actually deletes other genes in the genome. And we obtained the floxed FOXO mice from someone else. And so we then bred those mice together to generate the cardiomyocyte-specific knockout mice. In the paper, we describe a double transgenic mouse model. So we crossed the FOXO1 knockout mice with our constitutively active PI3K transgenic mice. And so that required a number of breeding steps, and we had a gazillion genotypes, and there were lots and lots and lots of mice to deal with.
Kate, I have a follow-up question about the Cre mice you were using. You mentioned on the paper that there was a couple of reports where they found the Cre mice that developed using the alpha MHC promoter. They mm-hmm. showed hypertrophy and dilated cardiomyopathy, and you did not observe this. Can you comment on this?
Sure. So it actually seems to be due to how much Cre is actually expressed. So there are a few different Cre mouse models out there, a few different alphamycin heavy chain Cre mouse models, and some of them have low levels of Cre expression and some have very high. So the one that we used, it has been used in lots of different studies before, but we couldn't actually find a really comprehensive analysis of the cardiac phenotype of just the Cre mice alone. So we thought that that was really important to do before we crossed the mice with our floxed FOXO mice. It's essential that when you're doing studies using a Cre transgenic mouse, that you do actually include Cre control mice in your analyses to check if there's an effect on heart function just of the Cre expression alone. We performed echo on the mice, did histology, did some qPCR, and at the Cre mice that we used seemed to be normal. Which
I actually thought it was a very strong point of your manuscript that you so carefully did all the phenotyping, because Cre is very useful and it's becoming really mainstream at the moment. But still, we are messing up with the DNA of the animal. So it is important to know if there's any side effects or if we're having any secondary effects that no one was expecting. So I believe each new strain should definitely be carefully phenotyped. Another thought I had when I was reading the manuscript, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I got the impression the study gave you a lot of unexpected data. Was that correct?
Yeah, so our hypothesis was that FOXO1 would be important for physiological hypertrophy, and we went ahead and did our swim study. So this was a chronic swim training protocol that induces physiological cardiac hypertrophy, and we did find that there was an attenuation of heart growth in the FOXO1 knockout mice. So that was consistent with our hypothesis. But then when we crossed the FOXO1 knockout mice with our constitutively active PI3K mice, this is a model of physiological cardiac hypertrophy due to activation of PI3K. And all of our studies up until that point had demonstrated that the hearts of these mice essentially mimic what happens when you exercise a mouse for 4 weeks. So they have a similar increase in heart size and normal or enhanced heart function. And so we were really surprised when we deleted FOXO from these mice, nothing actually happened to their hearts. The FOXO1 knockout hearts were exactly the same as the control hearts in the presence of constitutively active PI3K. And we checked in both males and females, but deletion of FOXO1 didn't play a role. This was actually why we couldn't figure out what was going on initially. But we did some follow-up studies, and we actually found that FOXO1 the expression of FOXO1 is actually already reduced in the hearts of constitutively active PI3K mice. So whether this is some sort of negative feedback mechanism or something that is happening because you've got constitutively active PI3K in those mice, we're not sure. But if FOXO1 is already reduced in the hearts of those mice, then deleting it is not going to have as great an effect as it would in a normal mouse. So that's what we think is happening, why there's a difference between the two models. But I guess the important result is from the exercise study where we exercise the mice. That's a physiological stimulus. And we found that loss of FOXO1 blunted the hypertrophic response. So we think that it is important for mediating physiological cardiac hypertrophy.
I did get that from the manuscript. As Charlotte said, it was beautifully written. I guess that's your history, all your training in history. But yeah, I was going through the figures and I was thinking, man, I bet there was a lot of moments they were looking at the data thinking, what the hell?
Yep. Yes, they were.
What we expected. But that's science, right?
Yes, it is.
It never goes where we think is going to take us.
And as I was reading the manuscript, I had a very classic Charlotte thought, which was to zero in on sex differences. So if you'll forgive me, I know this was a very small part of your study. You exercised the female mice and you wrote that that's because women have a more pronounced and reproducible hypertrophic response to exercise. So I mean, I have a million questions about this, but I guess the more basic question is, do you think that your results would then extend equally to male and female mice and maybe even male and female humans?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we had intended to exercise some male mice as well. But we, at the time, we just, because of the breeding strategy and the fact that you get all these different genotypes, we actually didn't have enough mice of the right genotype coming through at the same time to have a large enough batch of mice to exercise. So we just proceeded with the females in the end. But it's a really good question. I don't know what would happen in the males. We haven't really explored the sex angle very much. But we thought it was really important with both the basal phenotyping and also the constitutively active mice. We thought it was important to do both sexes. But with the exercise study, it is quite a labor-intensive protocol. And so once we'd done the female cohort, we just stuck with that.
Mm-hmm. I found I've never read about women's hearts. And again, this is really not my area, so maybe that's why. Having more pronounced hypertrophy. And I can't help but think, I wonder if this is something that becomes useful in pregnancy. As women's cardiac output increases and blood volume increases, that women's hearts are better able to undergo hypertrophy.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe there's an evolutionary thing there where, because our hearts do have to adapt to pregnancy, mm-hmm. Maybe they are more responsive to hypertrophic stimuli.
So, Kate, I want to dig a little bit on your story, the story behind the bench. Like Kara said in your introduction, you had to stop your research twice for maternity leave. So how was it coming back? I'm thinking the maternity leave in Australia is longer than it is in the US. Here, I believe it's anything between 8 to 12 weeks, maybe. I know I had 10 weeks. And coming back, it was like, oh my God, there's so much that I need to catch up on. So I can't even imagine if it was several months. So how did you, you know, just continue with your study?
To answer your question about coming back from mat leave, so things are quite different here in Australia. We're very lucky to have such a generous parental leave scheme. So for both my children, I was able to take 10 months off work, which was wonderful. And when I returned to work with both my children, my husband Derek actually took 2 months off to look after the kids when I first went back. And so that was fantastic because it meant that I could just go back to work without having to worry about the kids adjusting to childcare or anything like that, because I knew Derek was home looking after them. So that was that made a huge difference in terms of my career coming back to work. But it is really hard when you're not at work for 10 months. Science moves really quickly, right? So for both my periods of mat leave, I really did try to stay in touch. I worked on a few manuscripts while I was on mat leave. I submitted grant applications and fellowship applications to try and get funding for when I came back. Another thing that really helped was that I had supervised an honours student for a one-year research project, and she decided to do her PhD with me after she finished honours. And because I'd already spent a year in the lab training her up and she was familiar with the project, she was actually able to start her PhD while I was on mat leave. And then I came back as her primary supervisor after mat leave. So that was fantastic because it meant that the project kept going while I was on parental leave. Another thing that really helped was the Baker Institute has a gender equity and diversity committee, and they've come up with some really great initiatives to support women or parents who take a period of time to look after their kids. So I was awarded a Women in Science support grant, which allowed me to travel to a conference with my son, who was only 4 months old at the time. So I was breastfeeding and couldn't travel without him. So I was able to attend that conference with Thomas, and also my husband came along to look after him while I was at the conference. So things like that are incredibly helpful just in terms of staying in touch. So I'm really grateful for receiving that support.
That's fantastic. It really takes a village, right? And it's so important to have the right team, you know, in the lab and at home as well, supportive partner and supportive team members that keep things going on. That's one of the things I really like about science. You normally get really good colleagues. Everyone works for the same goal. Yes, very good.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree.
So Kate, one of the things that really piqued my interest in Kara's introduction was mentioning that you became hooked on working with Julie, maybe also research in general, when you heard her giving a talk to a group of undergrads. So I was curious, what was it about her talk that hooked you?
Good question. It was a long time ago. I remember being impressed at the time, but I think I found her research really interesting because she was talking about physiological hypertrophy and PI3K. And so the science interested me, and I really wanted to work with genetically modified mice, and Julie was offering a project in that space. But also she was just really nice and approachable. I had a brief chat to her after her presentation, and then emailed her and organized an interview. And so that's how everything happened.
That's wonderful. I love those stories. And actually, it brings up a follow-up question. One of the things that I really realized over the course of my career is how important it is to choose methodology as well as topic. And I love that you said that you really knew you wanted to work with transgenic mice. So how did you know that you wanted to work in this area?
I'd learned a lot about different methods that were being used to generate transgenic mice through my biochemistry subjects at uni. And it was just, it's such a fundamental technique for figuring out what genes and proteins do in the heart. So, well, not just the heart, any organ. I thought it would be great to get some experience working with genetically modified mice. And now that I've come back from my postdoc and I'm trying to establish an independent research program, I'm really trying to use the expertise that I obtained during my PhD, where I was working with several genetically modified mouse models, with the techniques that I picked up when I was doing my postdoc in London, to try and come up with my own independent research program, which is looking at phosphatases. So working with genetically modified mice is my bread and butter. It's so fundamental to what I do, to try and answer the scientific questions that I have.
Love that. Love when interest in methodology meets interest in physiology and theory. That's awesome.
Kate, what struck me about your story is how you've been able to navigate your career by design.
A lot of my choices were deliberate, and I feel very lucky that things have panned out how they have. I guess I always knew that I wanted to have kids and have a family, and it was actually something that I thought about a lot when I was doing my PhD in my second half of my 20s. It was something that I thought about and thought, you know, when on earth am I meant to have kids if I want to have an academic career? And I spoke to quite a few of my mentors about that. And basically everyone said, there's no right time. You just have to do what's right for you. And so at the end of my PhD, I did make that conscious decision of moving overseas to do a postdoc before we started a family. I thought it was really important to get a couple of years experience as a postdoc before starting a family. I thought that would help when I was coming back from mat leave. And when I was going on mat leave, I must admit that the thought of being away for so long was actually terrifying because science moves so fast. And I thought, oh my goodness, how am I going to stay on top of the literature and keep my project running? And that's where initiatives like the Women in Science Support Grant that I received from the Baker are just so important because it does allow you to actually stay in touch.
So nowadays, if you dig enough, I won't say they're everywhere, but there's a couple of mechanisms that are there to help, which is extremely important because, you know, not everyone wants to have a family, but for the female and male scientists that do want to take maternity leave, it's very important that they should not be penalized for that. It's not easy to be away from the lab, but, you know, with technology nowadays, you're always a phone call away. And especially, you know, this past year, we all saw that working from home can be done. Yes. Of course, you miss a lot because you're not in the lab running the experiments. But there's still things that you can do working from home with the new technology. So we all need to adapt. And I do this and I'm going to put it out there because I think everyone should do it. When I go to a meeting, I always contact the organizers and I ask for daycare. Mm-hmm. And most of the time they will say they do not have they won't have like any babysitting services or daycare services, but occasionally you will find a conference that provides the services. But I always make a point of sending that email so they're aware that there's something they should be providing. So go and do
the
same.
Totally agree. And I might start doing that too.
Thank you so much, Kate, for being here on this, my inaugural podcast. It was a great chatting with you and hearing about your journey. I feel like you're such an inspiring story. So it was wonderful chatting with you this morning.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. And it's been great getting to know you guys.
Thank you, Liz and Kara, for the wonderful conversation. And we'll see you all in our next episode of Behind the Bench.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell. Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJPHeart.